Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Carmine Leo. He's the owner of LifeCoaching.com and maintains a thriving practice providing organizations, teams, and individuals with an evidence-based methodology to develop an emotional intelligence and emotional self-management skills through coaching and training. Over the last 20 years, he's successfully coached hundreds of clients, from single moms to CEOs, from combat vet Marines to artists, musicians, and writers, from rocket science to scientists to permaculture communitarians, as well as working with clients within organizations such as Apple, Google, Raytheon, NASA, IBM, onsemi, General Atomics, The Washington Post, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and many others. Carmine was a co-developer in collaboration with Pam Leo of the parenting workshops Meeting the Needs of Children, which in 1995 were published as Pam's seminal book, Connection Parenting. So first, thank you for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here, Derek.
So the reason I wanted to specifically interview you was something I was reading that you had written about authoritarianism and child rearing. So can you talk about the relationship between those?
Yeah, sure. So it's there are some useful distinctions in this conversation. And the first one is authoritarian parenting is a style, and authoritarianism is a personality type. So those are very different things. And while they are somewhat connected, there's not necessarily a straight line between them. So in parenting, for example, one of the basic premises of connection parenting is that authoritarian parenting, which is do as I say, you know, because I said so, that sort of heavy-handed, top-down orders and restrictions, that sort of thing, punishment-driven, that doesn't work because ultimately it doesn't teach. It just causes fear and disconnection. Well, the typical reaction to that in a child that grows up under an authoritarian parenting regime, that child will either become an authoritarian parent like their parent was, or they'll become permissive. And permissiveness doesn't work either because it feels like abandonment to the child. So they don't know where the edges are. They don't know what the limits are. They know that they're kids. They know that the grown-ups are supposed to be on top of what's going on, and they feel left behind and left out. It's really quite scary. So, you know, the whole process of raising children is about building connection. The only leverage we have, and I think of my own son when I talk about this, the only leverage that we have when they get 16, 17 is going to be the depth and strength of our connection with them. You know, I'm 5'9", 5'9 and a half. My son is 6'4". Outmasses me by, you know, half again. So clearly, force and domination isn't going to work there. The only real power I have, the only influence, is through connection. So that's the first distinction. Now, if I recall the conversation that you noticed, it was I had said something about the difference between authoritarianism on the left and authoritarianism on the right.
Absolutely.
And I said, yeah, they. You know, they're very different things. And Bob Altmaier, we're going to talk a lot today about Bob Altmaier's book. It's called Authoritarianism. He's up at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, and he's a whiz-bang guy. And he's a scientist, and, you know, he does research, and we're looking for evidence. What's the clue? He makes some really, really useful decisions or distinctions in this process. So he says, I may paraphrase a bit here. He says, you know, if you ask the question, what is authoritarianism? Well, ultimately, it's something that authoritarian followers and authoritarian leaders cook up between themselves, right? It happens when followers submit too much to the leaders. They trust them too much. They give them too much leeway to do whatever they want, which often is something undemocratic, tyrannical, and brutal. when I was a kid growing up, we had authoritarian fascists. You know, we just kicked ass with the Nazis, you know, the Spanish Revolution, the Italians, the Japanese. And we saw the rise of authoritarian communist dictatorships, right? Those were the biggest threats in those days. And eventually there were some wars that went both hot and cold that, you know, we all... But authoritarianism itself hasn't gone anywhere, right? So, you know, I think we're going to talk a little bit about that. Now, we know an awful lot about authoritarian followers in one way or another. Hundreds of social scientists have studied them since World War II. We have a pretty good idea who they are, where they come from, what makes them tick. By comparison, we don't know a whole lot about authoritarian leaders because we only recently started paying attention to them. It may seem kind of strange, but, you know, how hard is it to figure out why someone would like to have massive amounts of power? I mean, that, you know, why would somebody prefer a dictatorship to freedom? So the social scientists have focused on the followers for a long time because typically, historically, they've been seen as the main underlying problem. One of the keys in this whole conversation is that authoritarians, the leaders, tend to get their followers to do all the dirty work and they keep their hands clean. I mean, Hitler's a case in point. You know, it was his followers that did this. And the distinction that I was trying to make when I said that when they get extreme, when they go far enough around the bend, and this was sort of a poke at postmodernism, when the left goes far enough around the bend, they eventually meet the right, and they become authoritarians themselves. And one of the things that Bob Altmaier says, the revolution seeds the next dictatorship. So, his difference, the distinction he makes between left and right, is a right-wing authoritarian are those who are supporting the in-place power structure. The left-wing authoritarian is those who are supporting the revolution. So, at the beginning, you know, in the October Revolution, Engels and Marx and all those cats, they were the revolutionaries, they were the left. But very, very quickly, they became the right. And then we wound up with Stalin, who was, you know, about as right-wing and authoritarian as you can ever hope to see. Right? And we see this replicated all the way through. When I was a kid, who was it, the Weatherman? I keep trying to call him the Weather Underground, but that's a weather channel, a climate channel. There were revolutionaries. There were Marxists when I was a kid back in the 60s. And these people were really left-wingers. Had they ever acquired any power, they would have become right-wingers, ultimately, because they would have been in that place. Does that make sense?
Well, I keep thinking about the Who song, Won't Get Fooled Again.
Yeah, right. And we do, every time, right? It just keeps biting us in the ass. So, you know, Altmaier, he's pretty sharp about this stuff, and he's got a whole raft of distinctions. So he calls them RWA, right? Right-wing authoritarian. And he has a scale. There's an assessment that he does that you know, with a couple dozen, 20, 25 questions or something, and you answer on a plus or minus scale, minus 4 or 5 to plus 4 or 5. Whether you agree or disagree. And that helps you figure out if you're high or low on the RWA scale. So that's one. So authoritarians who are high tend to be submissive, right? They have a high degree of submission to the established legitimate authority in their society, whatever that is. They also have high levels of aggression in the name of that authority, and they have a high level of conventionalism, right? They want to fit in. They want to be like everybody else. But now we add in another scale, and this is the social dominance orientation scale. This also is high or low, right? So, and he's the social domination, I mean, they're this is about how much power do you want to have to acquire. He's got an assessment for that also. So somebody who is low in RWA, right-wing authoritarianism, people like you and me, we would also be low in the social dominance orientation, right? We don't want power over others. In fact, my whole body of work in emotional intelligence is about supporting people in acquiring real power over themselves, which is a, you know, anathema to our authoritarians, right? So, any question about any comment so far?
Yeah, I'm thinking about, the classic right-wing authoritarian, you said they would be submissive to power and simultaneously aggressive. And so can we give a couple historical examples? Would that be – and I'm wondering where – sorry if this is a terribly ill-formed question, but I'm thinking about in culture of make-believe, I one of the things that I talked about a lot is how if you have an economic downturn, you can expect a rise in right-wing authoritarianism. Like the KKK exploded after in difficult times, and the Nazis were in some ways a consequence of the dreadful economic times of Germany in the 1920s. And I'm wondering, are we talking about different things, or what's the relationship between relationship between the as you lose your economic status, you can turn toward authoritarianism? Take this inchoate question anywhere you want.
Yeah, right. No, and you're right. This is complicated. There are a lot of moving parts.
Wait, there's one more thing I want to say, which is earlier you were saying there is, when you're talking about the submissive to authority, I was thinking about the famous line about Mussolini that he made the trains run on time. And isn't part of the attraction, too, that there is a certain stability that comes with authoritarianism and a certain settledness that comes with authoritarianism, too?
Yeah, that's a great question. In fact, somewhere in his book, he talks about the aspect of this that you're talking about is social dominators, right? Those become the leader, right? So when the social dominators are in the driver's seat, and the right-wing authoritarians, the submissives, stand at their beck and call, unethical things start to appear much more likely to happen, right? So it's true, as your case with Mussolini, sufficiently skilled social dominators served by dedicated followers can absolutely make the trains run on time. They have to worry about what the trains are hauling when the dominators are calling the shots and highly submissive RWAs are doing the shooting, right? The trains may be loaded with people crammed into boxcars headed for the death camp, right? So, you know, this is what we're seeing now, and the high social dominators in the Trump cartel are in the driver's seat, right? And all these offended, angry, fearful, self-righteous, obedient, and submissive high RWAs are at his beck and call. And this is key, right? They're very high in prejudice. Both the social dominators and the RWAs are filled with prejudice, except that they're prejudiced against different groups. But at the core, they're all filled with contempt for the other, right? And once in a while, you can see some of this leak through in Trump's expressions. Paul Ekman, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, he's the guy who did micro expressions, right? He calls this duping delight when the social dominator or the sociopath, the psychopath, when they get it that they're fooling you, you can see this little micro expression that they're just delighted by it, right? So the marriage of those two groups, the social dominators and the submissive followers, the RWAs, it's called a lethal union in psychology now. That's a known thing. In fact, Columbine, right, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, in that pairing, the lethal union, Harris was the social dominator, right? He was the psychopath. And Klebold was the RWA submissive. He was very depressed and very poorly emotionally regulated. So they fueled each other, and they planned this stuff for a year, right? And you can see, when you understand these background patterns, you start to see these behaviors. You know, the key is, and you can watch this, right? First off, the RWAs have to be offended. Then they get angry about this. And they are highly fearful. They live in the dangerous world. And this is one of the disconnects between authoritarian parenting and children growing up to be authoritarians themselves or not. There are a lot of mitigating factors, like I said earlier, a lot of moving parts in this. So if the authoritarian parent creates a sense of the world around that child is highly fearful, then that child grows up and they want to maintain order, stability, control, right? Because if these days get out of hand, you know, oh my God, it's the end of civilization, right? So, and they tend, because they're highly prejudiced, they pick on the out-groups. So it could be, you know, especially women, both the RWAs and the social dominators are really contemptuous of women. So that's the first layer in this stuff. And then there are, you know, black people, Jewish people, you know, people of color, people of a different religion, people from a different country, you know, yada, 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 fill in the blank. But it's always the other. So, you know, look at the process. They get offended, then they get angry. They're already fearful. They live in a culture of fear. Then the trigger for violence is self-righteousness, and that comes as a blessing from the social dominators. So, you know, Trump gets up there and says, lock her up, or send her back, or, you know, whatever asshole stuff he says. And here come all of these obedient and submissive high RWAs, and they're ready to go, and they've got all this contempt. So it just needs a trigger. People say, you know, a lot of people, well, you can't blame Trump for these shootings. Well, you absolutely can, because he's reaching out to the most afraid, to the most unstable, the most poorly self-regulated, and he's giving them his blessing. I mean, this is his. This is entirely his. And it's not just him. I mean, it's everywhere. You know, it's kind of interesting to me, if you have a social dominator that's really loud out there in the world, he's a nut job. They're a clown. Nobody takes them seriously. But you give them 38 million obedient followers, and all of a sudden we've got the Third Reich. You know, you look at what's going on with Trump, it's the same deal. So, you know, there are very particular traits among the RWAs that tend to carry over. These are almost universal. Number one, they're illogical thinking. They have highly compartmentalized minds. They have a lot of double standards. There's a great deal of hypocrisy. How many of these guys have we seen? I mean, look at Tom DeLay. You know, look at all of these homophobic, you know, they're Bible thumping, preaching, and they get caught in a men's room stall with a guy, right? Or in their office or whatever it is. The hypocrisy is there. They're blind to themselves. They have a profound ethnocentrism. They see themselves as the only acceptable group. So anybody that's part of the out-group, and for most of these guys, it's women, are part of the out, that's where it really gets nasty. And then they're dogmatic. I mean, that's the authoritarian's last-ditch defense. It's exactly what Bob calls it, you know, the last-ditch defense, dogmatism. So these are really, they're highly prejudiced, both the social dominant scale and the right-wing authoritarian scale, and but their prejudice for slightly different groups, and the place they overlap most is with women.
So one of the things, there's a couple things I've been thinking as you said this. One of them was when you were talking about the outrage, I was thinking how much this applies to personal abusive situations too. I mean, that's one of the things that's central to a lot of my work is how the micro and the macro so often fit together. That
yep.
we have, in an individual abusive situation, it is extremely rare for a batterer to batter because he is an abuser. Instead, he battered because the dishes weren't cleaned well enough or because
right.
you were late. I mean, there's always this outrage and this DARVO, I believe is the term, which is deny, attack, reverse
yep.
victim, and offender. And we
yep.
see that both on, I mean, I'm not saying this actually, this is the Nazis talking, the Nazis, the German people, were the victims of the Jews. So they're actually acting in self-defense, and they
That's
were the
right.
victims of the Poles. The Poles, the Polish army actually attacked the Germans. I mean, of course it didn't, but that was their excuse. That was honest to goodness. This is, you know, William Shirer rising
oh,
up
yeah.
the Third Reich. That
yeah.
actually the Poles, for some stupid reason, attacked Germany, and therefore Germany had to attack. And it's a coincidence that they had their entire army ready on the border, ready to attack. You know, 15
right, right.
minutes after the Poles attacked. I mean, of course, I'm not. This is not what really happened. But Robert J. Lifton has this great thing about how before you can commit any mass atrocity, and this is true for individual atrocities too, you have to convince yourself and others that what you're doing is actually a virtue. You have to have a claim to virtue.
That's right. That's exactly what Bob Altemeyer says. That self-righteousness. So look at what you just articulated there. There's the offense, the rightful anger. Everybody's afraid, oh, they're coming to get us. And the self-righteous justification. That self-righteousness is the flip switch that turns it to violence. Every time. It's got to be there.
So
all the gaslighting, it's like you were, oh, yeah, the trigger. Yeah, the trigger is the trigger of violence is the self-righteous blessing. Yeah. We are justified in doing this. Yeah, that's it. So look what you made me do, right? Now I have to do this to you because, you know, you didn't wash the dishes or, you know, there's a crumb on the kitchen table.
Which, by the way, is not only authoritarianism. One of the jokes I used to say at my talks is that I have never in my life been a jerk, by which I meant that every time I've been a jerk, I have had it fully rationalized.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
I mean, so it's not just Trump and it's not just Hitler, but this is just a standard coping mechanism, how you get through the day and how you do things that aren't particularly nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in fact can be quite awful.
Yeah.
Let's switch for a second and talk about a little bit more about the left-wing authoritarianism, because that's something that has really, you know, when I wrote Culture Make Believe, one of the things I'm pretty proud of is that I predicted the rise of the Tea Party. And what I did not predict was the rise of the sort of current authoritarianism and the current left-wing authoritarianism that is not in power, but that basically runs academia and that I think has frankly destroyed the left.
Yeah, I agree.
So yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that? Does it come from the same roots, or does that have...
Well, yes, and in fact, I think it does. So there are a couple of drivers in this. In fact, do you remember Milgram? Do you remember his experiments on obedience, the shocker guy?
Yeah, but you should tell the listeners.
Milgram, he was, I think he was at Yale. And this is back, what, in the 40s or 50s. This is quite a while ago. So he did this experiment, and I may get some particulars of this wrong, but generally, what he did was he set up an experiment. He advertised in the paper, and he got all these people that answered. And he said he assigned one to be a teacher and one to be a learner. And then they sat in a room. He would have one of his grad students or somebody be the experimenter. And so I'm going to give you, you know, the experimenter would say to the teacher, here, read this stuff. And the teacher would read this, you know, here's a five pairs of words. And if the learner gets them all right, now they're strapped in a chair and their hand is on a metal plate, right? So if the learner gets them correct, then he just goes to the next set of word pairs. If the learner gets them incorrect, then the teacher has 30 switches in 15 volt increments, starting at 15 volts up to 450, right? So he's got all these switches, and so he's supposed to shock the learner, and because the way the experiment was framed is this is looking at the effect of punishment on memory or something like that. It was the effect of something on memory. This is a learning exercise. So, and, you know, every time the rules were, every time the learner missed an answer, the teacher was to shock them. And they went through, and some appalling number, 80% of these people shocked all the way up to 450 volts, which is lethal. Right? And even those that disobeyed protested mildly. And only a small handful, I think 9 out of however many, so there were a lot in that group, 45 or something, 9 said no. But everybody else went all the way. And it was just appalling. So they did all kinds of variations of this. And a couple of things that they observed that they noticed that were drivers. If somebody is on their own, they are very, very likely to be obedient to authority, almost unconditionally. And, you know, what's his name? Altemeyer, he writes in that chapter, he says, the RWA scale and the social dominance scale don't tell us how authoritarian we are. They only suggest how authoritarian we are inclined to be. What tells us how authoritarian we are is our behavior. And then he makes this quip. He says, hi, my name is Bob. I can be an authoritarian. And I think that's what you were poking at, you know, a few minutes ago, talking about being a jerk, right? This is the same kind of thing. We all have this capacity. One of the great failures in modern education is it does not teach us how to resist inappropriate authority. One of the things my kids grew up knowing is, hey, listen, if you have a sense that an authority figure is telling you something wrong, you have a right to resist. Now, you have to do that in a way that doesn't get you shot, right? But, you know, so be smart about it. But you are, you know, and we see this. There was a terrible example of this with the something like 500 policemen in the Nazi army who had all been cops. They were all over 40. So they were too old to be, you know, soldiers on the front line. And they were assigned to go exterminate this village. There were 1,800 people in that village. And, you know, one guy said he didn't want to do it. And his immediate officer got all over his case. But the guy who was in charge of the unit said, no, it's okay. And immediately 9 or 10 more bailed. Right? So there are two pieces in this. One is, we need to figure out how to disobey authority and do that when our inner sense is telling us something's wrong. The second thing is peer pressure. In groups, like they've done experiments, you put one person in a room and filling out a job application. This is a case in point. Filling out a job application, the room fills with smoke. That person will get up and leave the room. you put three people in there and fill the room with smoke, and they'll sit there till they can't breathe and they can't see before somebody panics and gets up and leaves, and everybody runs, right? So peer pressure, we don't want to be different. We want to be like everybody else. We don't want to stand out. So those two pieces really matter, right? Now, I forgot where the point was, but those were speaking directly to that, to whatever that was. I forget now what it was.
Well, we were...
Oh,
we
yes,
were,
you were talking about the left, right?
Yes, we were making our way to the left.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So with the left, you get people who are rebellious. I mean, look at the resistance against the Vietnam War. That was clearly the left. We were organized. I got my head bashed in the Chicago riots. You know, I was ripe at that age, in 68. And, you know, I got my head bashed in Washington, D.C., walking in the anti-segregation marches. I mean, that was a very powerful, strong left. And look at what, you know, the rights of women were going on. But we got co-opted, right? And it's like I said before, the revolution contains the seeds of the next dictatorship. So none of us ever got any power, really. None of the left ever got any real power. But what you see happening, this reminds me, one of my old teachers, this is, oh God, probably 40, 45 years ago. One of my old teachers one day got up in my face at the top of his voice, nose to nose. He said, "You think reality actually is what you think reality is. And I'm here to tell you it's not." And this is one of the great crashes of postmodernism. Everything falls down with this bullshit that it's all relative. It's not relative. We create the standards. We create the judgments. You know, this is how we have to live together. If I tell you it's wrong to rape children, it's wrong to rape children, and you can't get around that because we as a society have decided that this is a right and wrong. So you can't go out there, you know, like some of the queer theorists are doing, and saying, well, you know, if there's no harm, if there's, you know, give me a break. This is not real. Right? There is an independent reality that exists irrespective of our attitudes, beliefs, feelings, and opinions about it. You know, doesn't matter who you are, gravity will always win. It's just that straightforward. You know, one of my other teachers used to say, rocks are hard, water's wet, what is, what ain't. And there's no bridge in that, right? Reality exists in and of itself. So along comes the left, and they adopt this, and they get sold this nonsense, and then they start to rise to positions of power and authority. And this is exactly what you're talking about in the university and education, right? The revolution contains the seeds of the next dictatorship. So the left incrementally is becoming the authoritarian right. As they accrue power, right? So now you've got whole departments. I mean, if you say the wrong thing, you can get fired, deplatformed. I mean, this is the left becoming authoritarian right wing. Does that make sense? Is that clear?
Yes, it does. And you might do a few sentences on just what postmodernism is for those who are fortunate enough to not have encountered postmodernism yet.
Oh God, a definition? Oh come on, Derek, you've got a better definition than I have.
Well, I'll just throw out that postmodernism emerged from a really smart idea, and actually postmodernism makes me question human sentience, honestly.
Yeah.
Because postmodernism emerged from the understanding that most of the stories that we've been told are the winners tell the stories. So most of the stories we've been told have been told from a Eurocentric perspective. The accomplishments of men are valorized, the accomplishments of women are denied, the accomplishments of white people are valorized, the accomplishments of people of color are not. And so the recognition that the stories we've been told have been, you know, basically you put five people in a room and they all tell different stories. And,
yeah.
And postmodernism begins with the understanding that we tell these stories about how we live. That's fine. That's really smart. That's great. But then they take it to, because we all tell different stories, that means there is no reality.
Yeah.
And that means that all there is stories, which is the stupidest idea in the history of the planet.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is, and part of the problem is, that once you say there is no reality, but there's only the stories we tell, the only way you can win an argument, because you can no longer rely on facts, because there is no such thing as facts, so you can't say sexually abusing children harms children. You can only say the stories we tell ourselves make it seem like sexually abusing children harms them. You can't actually talk about, because they've said there is no physical reality. And I'm not making this stuff up. People are listening to this going,
I know, yeah.
Yeah, this is crazy. But yes, it is crazy, but it's also what's taught in academia. And so once you have established that there are no facts, the only way you can win your argument is by not allowing the other people to speak, which is what we see constantly at this point and then we'll just go very brief. I'll finish this up by another little bit of a rant on queer theory, which queer theory starts with the idea. Queer theory starts with another great question. How did certain things become normal? Like, how did it become normalized? I mean, that's a great question. We can ask that generally. How did capitalism become normalized? And they're specifically asking this about sex. But they start with a good question, and they end up being really stupid again, which is because strictures against homosexuality are wrong, therefore, they say, all strictures against all forms of sexuality, including pedophilia, bestiality, sadism, are wrong. And that's just crazy.
Yeah,
but the only way they can win arguments is the same thing. It's the same thing. The only way they win arguments is by deplatforming anybody who disagrees with them.
That's right. Yeah. You know, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to ask. Go ahead, please.
So
I've been talking too much.
No, you're not. This is great. I live for conversations like this, Derek. I just do. So one of the interesting consequences of all of that is that people begin to silo in like groups. So, you know, then you have everybody who was a sexual abuse survivor in one group. They were terribly victimized. And then you have everybody who's suffered from racism in another group. And then, you know, it keeps going. You get all of these groups, and the gradations become finer and finer and finer until the ultimate consequence is that everybody is oppressed in their own little group of one. There's no common ground anymore because my wound is bigger and more important than yours. Right? And this just, it pours right into narcissism. At least that's how it appears from my view. Yeah.
And it seems that, I mean, there's two directions I wanted to go. One, I want to come back to child-rearing practices in a moment.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Before then, one of the things that this makes me think of is, when you talk about the silo effect, it seems that the internet makes this much worse because then you can find people who are within that same aspirational group as opposed to the way communities normally worked through all of human existence is that much of our community was geographically based.
Yep.
And therefore you're going to, almost by definition, get a cross section of people. So within your community, there might be a few who are sexually abused whom you might communicate with, but at the same time, you still deal with your neighbor, this other neighbor over here, and you are not in a community that is so strictly siloed, to use your word.
Yeah. You know, in fact, this speaks one of the interests. I'm a regenerative agriculture guy and a permie and all that sort of thing. One of the areas that I have shifted my attention to, I've done a lot of work, you know, doing this emotional intelligence development work in the corporate space. And this is a little tiny sidebar here. until I encountered you, I thought of myself as one of the most dangerous subversives in North America. And the reason for that was I would go in and work with a $200,000 a year senior executive, and within 18 months after completing the program with me, that person would feel so choked and strangled in the box that they were in the corporate arena, that they would leave that position, take all of that skill and talent and go elsewhere with it and find a way to create a meaningful life. And so I laughed myself to sleep so many times thinking about this, that, you know, here are these remarkable people in positions of power, and when they wake up and become a human being, they go, oh my God, what am I doing? And they exit stage left as soon as they can. That's a total sidebar. But one of the interests that I've really developed of late, one of my good friends is the former chief of one of the local native tribes, the Penobscot Nation, and he's just a remarkable man. I love him dearly. And we have had many conversations about this topic. We white people and Westerners in general, anybody who's not indigenous, we have lost the great knack of living well with one another. And I know how that works. So one of the key interests in my work going forward is to expand into these intentional communities of regenerative agriculture groups and permaculture, because that is a skill if we're going to survive the climate shift that's coming. And I think it's possible that we might, then we're going to have to figure out how do we get along with each other without, you know, sneaking around behind the haystack and shooting one another with an AR-15. We need to develop that self-regulation and that perception and relationship skill, the communication skills that we used to have, that we were evolved for, that we are biologically hardwired to do very, very well. But because it's a learned skill, we've forgotten how to do that, right? The culture, this is the overculture again, it's the stuff that you talk about. This industrial civilization is about meeting the needs of the economy instead of the needs of the human beings that live within it, or the landscape around us that we depend on. So I want to move our attention and skill back to that, you know, and right-wing authoritarians, if you look at them in their own groups, they have some good qualities. The black and white dichotomy isn't neither real nor useful, right? It's they're earnest, they're hardworking, they're happy, they're charitable, they're very supportive of people within their own in-group, good friends, and so on. You know, and social dominators, they're ambitious and competitive. Those are cardinal virtues, and if you want to get ahead in this world, we might think otherwise. But it's a big mistake to see people as all bad, to see them as useless as it is to see them as all good. But the downside remains, right? It's really there. The presentation of all the research, you know, that Altmaier and all the others, I gave you a list of a half dozen other books that talk about this stuff, this research hasn't passed through any kind of ideological or theoretical filter, right? It's in every experiment, right? Low RWAs and low social dominators had as much chance to look bad as their counterparts on the high end, and they seldom did, right? The criminality shows up. If they can get away with it, they will. They are interested in power. Right, I talk about in my work, I say we're all looking to get our needs met. That's it. We're just trying to get our needs met and live a good life, right? It's that simple. The important thing to know is people in the cluster B, people on the high dominator scale, they have different needs than you and I. If they're a psychopath, sociopath, or a malignant narcissist, their needs are not the same as you and me. They want self-gratification. They want self-aggrandizement. You know, they have no conscience, no empathy, very directed impulse control only when it serves their interest, right? And they are driven to win. They want power. and many of them like to hurt you. So that you know, if you're going into an interaction with somebody on the other side of that fence and you think that you can be rational and good with them, I'm sorry, it's not likely to be successful. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts here, right? It's complicated.
Yeah, and we only have like 5 minutes left.
Okay.
There's a few directions I'm thinking, and you can take any of them. One of them is, I keep thinking about something that the Okanagan writer and activist Jeanette Armstrong said to me about how she said, we Indians have the same problems that white people have. We squabble, we don't get along, we dislike each other, and then we like each other later. But the big difference is that we know that my great-grandchildren might marry your great-grandchildren,
right.
So we figured out ways to get along.
That's right. That's exactly right, yes. Brilliant.
And so that's one part, but then I'm also, God, this is such a huge topic, that I'm thinking about, you were talking about the right-wing authoritarian sort of style of parenting, and isn't there also, you just mentioned the permissiveness, isn't there a problem also with being too permissive with children? And doesn't that also lead to a different form of dysfunction?
Yeah, absolutely it does. And in fact, you know, this is a topic about which there happens to be an entire book. It's called Connection Parenting by Pam Leo. We developed, Pam and I jointly developed a 7-week workshop for parents, and we did this publicly out there in the world. We also did it for incarcerated parents in the prison system, and it was extraordinary. This was a 3-year grant with the University of Maine that put us into the prison system working with incarcerated parents. Their premise was that these patterns that get people incarcerated are cross-generational. And so if you can interrupt the cycle in between one generation and the next, you can prevent that. And the way you do that, of course, is by building connection. You know, it's just like AA. The only place where AA ever works, and there's a ton of abuse in that organization, the only place it ever works is because it builds connection. It builds relationships. And that, to the degree which it works, that is entirely based on the connection and relationship that it builds. So, you know, the same thing in the prison system. This program was so successful with the prison population that after the university grant ended, they found money on their own. The actual prison staff found funding for another 11 years. That's really important. Right? So, Pam and I, we developed these workshops. We were actually doing family daycare. So we had 12 little kids under the age of 10, some school age, but mostly 7 and under because they were preschoolers. We had 12 kids every day, 5 days a week. And one of the things that we noticed was that there was a real disparity between how the parents were raising the kids and how the kids were treated in our daycare. So we developed this workshop to bring the parents in line with our premises about how, you know, what really works for kids. And it grew and it grew and it grew. It started out with, you know, self-esteem and then communication and then discipline and behavior and that sort of thing. And it just expanded to a 7-week workshop. So it was about, well, by the time all was said and done, it was close to 20 hours, right? And then, you know, Pam and I got divorced and she wrote the book and I was helped. We're still very good friends. We've been divorced for over 25 years. I adore that woman. She's just brilliant. Anyway, so the book is out there. If you want a really good answer to the trouble with permissiveness, as I mentioned earlier, it's abandonment. Kids experience it as having no edge. There's no boundaries. And we really need healthy boundaries. So the only way through all of that is to build connection. And you know, teach. In this process, one of the third chapters called Healing the Feeling Child, right? It's about how, what do we do with feelings when a, you know, a kid goes ballistic with you know, spillover from emotional poor emotional self-regulation. How do you teach kids that skill? Well, the first thing that you do is you manage it. You manage yourself appropriately. So the parents need to learn self-regulation and self-management, and in that process, they model it, and then they can teach their kids. We could have another one of these on that alone, if you wanted.
Well, I was thinking that would be good. And here we are, unfortunately, running out of time. So
all right.
We've covered an awful lot of ground today.
Yeah,
can you, like, spend 1 to 2 minutes summing up everything we've talked about today and telling us how we can move forward and make a better society?
Well, how do we make a better – well, all right. Long-term strategies, reduce fear. Reduce self-righteousness. This is a conversation in itself. You have to gnaw away at the religious roots of ethnocentrism. You know, teach kids to not trust authority automatically, right? Look at the data-driven solutions. You know, Bob, it's a free download. It's a PDF. I sent you, you can post it on the website or wherever you do that. It's a free download. Read Bob Altemeyer's book and share it with the people that you know, right? Trust the data-driven solutions. We know what this is, and we know how it works. You know, in the short term, as he says in the book, there's an imperative. Speak out now or forever, perhaps, be silenced. We, you know, get out there and vote. The only power we have is at the ballot box, and they do not want you to vote. You know, they want, social dominators want you to be disgusted with politics. They want you to feel hopeless. They want you out of their way. They want democracy to fail, right? They want equality destroyed as a value. They want to control everything and everybody. They want it all. And they have an army of followers marching in step with them, you know, with that old-time religion. This is a crusade. You know, we gotta stand up and say no. So, yeah, that's probably more than you wanted, but.
No, that's great. So thank you so much for that, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Carmine Leo. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.